AM 1290 and 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio WHIO and Sim Trainer Indoor Range and Firearms Training Center present Shooting from the Hip. It's straight talk about firearms, ammunition, self-defense, when and where you can carry, legislation, and legal issues. All about safety, training, and so much more. Your hosts are Jeff Pedro and Mark Avery. Jeff is a 24-year veteran police officer, currently assigned City of Kettering Detective, and owner and lead instructor at Sim Trainer. Mark is a retired Air Force officer, senior staff instructor at Sim Trainer, and NRA-certified instructor in multiple disciplines. They're here to bring to the microphone the truth about guns. Join them by calling 457-1290. Now, Shooting from the Hip. On AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM. News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training center, located at 2031 Dryden Road in Moraine, right across from DP&L. You can reach us by phone at 937-293-3914, and you can reach us on the web at www.sim-trainer.com. I want to dedicate today's show to, since this is Memorial Day weekend, to the men and women of our armed services who paid the ultimate sacrifice promoting democracy and freedom around the world throughout time. This is a very special day, and just last night I was driving down to the range to get some work done, and I was kind of reminiscing back to my childhood days and thinking about Memorial Day. And one of the things I remember so vividly as a kid was there were two days that were real important. That was the Christmas parade and the Memorial Day parade. And as Mark mentioned earlier, they called it there was a different name back then. It was
Decoration Day.
And in my town in northeastern Ohio, I grew up in a town called Massillon, northeastern part of the state, just south of Cleveland, big football town. Every Memorial Day, it was a big deal. The citizens of the community would line a couple of the major streets, and the high school band led off the parade, and much of the parade consisted of military vehicles that were stored at the, I guess it was the National Guard Armory outposts at that time. And it was a big deal for us kids to sit there on the curb and hold our flags and wave our flags as those servicemen drove by. And it was I have chills just thinking about it today. And, you know, that was back in the mid-60s on into the early 70s. And then for a lot of reasons, we lost, I think my personal opinion is we lost touch of what was important, and we let other things take priority because they discontinued those parades. And I know there's financial considerations and things of that nature, but you know, we have Holiday at Home parade here in the Dayton area in the fall, and I think we need to go back to commemorating a Memorial Day in a little bit more symbolic way, and it would be very fitting and I think appropriate for our young people to be involved in things like that. And it's something that I miss so dearly, and I wish we could somehow reclaim what we had in the past. Mark, what are your feelings about that?
I think that that sometimes we have sacrificed some of the ceremonial aspects of things that have been done over the years. And I think that that's a loss to our society, because we need to remember. We need times to set aside specifically to remember what's been done on our behalf, what the price was that people paid in order to earn for us the freedom that we sometimes take for granted. I think back, we have one of our friends who works at the range, Scott Bunker, who gave quite a bit. He did not lose his life. He lost one eye and part of his lung and had some other severe injuries. One of the young men that pulled him out during that conflict was Lance Corporal Nick Erty. And Nick lost his life just a few days after that to an IED. So with the conflict that's going on right now, there are probably a lot more people in our society who know someone very recently who has lost his life, either knew that person or knows someone who's a family member or a close friend. And as a result, I think it's really our duty to remember and to thank those people who are still left behind, who are still paying a tremendous emotional price in the loss of their loved ones, as well as those who have gone long before. I mean, we think about even all the way back to the American Revolution, those men and women sacrificed greatly in order to earn for us the freedom that we currently have sometimes taken for granted. And although we still enjoy a tremendous amount of freedom, and there is no other country that directs what we do, we are still a free country in that respect. We've lost a lot of those individual freedoms that they paid an ultimate sacrifice for, that they gave their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors to protect, to earn for us.
And another thing, you know, you're talking about some of the things that we do here on the show and some of the issues we address. We talk about protecting the Second Amendment, which we all hold dear to our hearts. But for the efforts of those individuals who paid that sacrifice, we wouldn't have the ability to voice our opinions and to have structured debate and ordered society. And it's very important. And I think we need to reflect on that and know that it's much broader than some of the issues we bring up here. It's controversial, and we get a little bit hot and heated and concerned about different things, but it goes way, way, way beyond that. And I want to bring up another thing that there's two series, I guess, on HBO and on pay-per-view television, Band of Brothers and the Pacific. And you can say what you like about the realism, but the simple fact is I was watching a couple of episodes of Pacific, which in my mind is the kind of the sequel to Band of Brothers, reenacting incidents that occurred in the Second World War, both on the European continent and over in the Pacific. And my 13-year-old son was sitting there last night, and he was kind of awestruck about the sacrifices those soldiers made. In one episode, sitting in kind of stuck on an island for 46 days without any reinforcements, without any rations, under terrible conditions. And what he failed to realize is many of those men were as old as his brother, who's in college right now, 19 and a half to 21 years of age.
And younger.
And younger, stuck out on the island, never been away from home except for that experience, and they had to be put through that. And when you think back to the hardships they'd endured, we complain about, you know, being an economic downturn in our country. I'm sorry, I just can't compare it. I know there's people that have things bad, but after what I see there, which I believe based on the interviews of some of the people that they talk about, and realize this is now 60-plus years later, and there's a few of those individuals around, and in those episodes they interview men who were actually there talking about the conditions, we have nothing to complain about. In my mind, it's a minor inconveniences that we deal with here compared to true problems and true issues of basic sustenance that they were dealing with each and every day. The one guy in the show last night, he had a little book. It was actually his Bible. And on the back page of his Bible, he was just marking the days, because they knew it one day they hopefully were going to be rotated out if things continued to go. And they finally got to that point in episode 10 last night, and it was a happy moment for them, obviously, but the hardships they'd endured. This whole weekend, you know, we're going to be getting together and having cookouts with family, and we're going to go to the amusement park, and we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to get ready for vacation. Let's kind of really put this in perspective and take a few moments to think about what this is all about. It's a pretty powerful message that we need to deliver to, like Mark said, our society today, because we've done away with some of those symbolic things that commemorate this holiday. We need to take the time to educate our young people and to spend the time to pay homage to the people that went before us.
I think that's a great idea. So maybe you have a comment, or maybe you have something that you'd like to share with respect to Memorial Day, somebody that you know that you've lost, and you'd like to just say thank you for their sacrifice and to their family. And feel free to give us a call here at 457-1290. And we are going to move on a little bit. We're going to talk about some other issues. There's certainly plenty of other things going on during this last week. But let's not forget what it is that gave us the right that we currently have to speak freely, to carry firearms, to petition our government for redress of grievances, to freely express and practice whatever religion we choose, or no religion if we choose. These are sacrifices that were made to give us these rights that we sometimes take for granted. Yes, I realize that we were endowed by our Creator with those rights, and that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights did not grant them to us, but they were protected by people who sacrificed their own lives in order to ensure that the government could not take away from us as Americans the rights that had been taken away from them as citizens of other nations and are still being taken away from citizens of other nations as we speak. Let's go ahead and take our first break for the hour. Give us a call at 457-1290. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro on a Memorial Day shooting from the hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
This is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners back to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip on this beautiful Memorial Day weekend. I want to encourage our callers to call in at 457-1290. That's 457-1290 with any firearms-related issues that you might be concerned about, any questions you might have, anything we might be able to help you with firearms training or related matters, and we'll be glad to get you on the air. I want to also mention that this has been a pretty busy week in the news, the national news and the local news, and I just wanted to point out a couple things and maybe spur a little bit of discussion on some of the topics. And the first one that really got me was the president from Mexico coming up here, and I guess the best way I can personally describe it is the debacle presentation he gave in front of our Congress and the ovations that he got. It was very unnerving.
It was embarrassing.
It was embarrassing, very ridiculous. But one thing that was particularly unnerving was he alluded to the fact that the cessation of the assault weapons ban in the United States in 2006 resulted in a substantial spike in violent crime in his country. There's absolutely no data to substantiate that. That was just simply a phrase that he threw out there. And you got to understand what's going on in Mexico, and of course we don't get a lot of information about it. But right now it's the gangs and the drug lords that are creating a lot of the problems, and it has nothing to do with the guns from the United States being a major problem there. And it's just it's rhetoric. It's strictly falsehood that's being promoted as truth, and it gets the news because it's the agenda of the current administration. And the news media tends to slant that way anyway. They tend to be generally anti-gun, but there's no truth to what they're saying. And there's certainly, let me say this, I'm not going to say there's no truth, but there's no substantiated documentation to back up what they say. But the sad thing is they get that out there, the people who don't know believe it, and then it creates problems when we try to debate the issue because they take it as truth.
One of the things that makes the whole statement just a complete fallacy on its face, it's so obviously incorrect that it almost doesn't even bear discussion, but because it is in the media and because it's a question that not everybody is familiar with the details, I think it's important that we address. The assault weapons ban, in the first place, was a misnomer. None of the weapons ban are accurately considered assault rifles, which is, by definition, a machine rifle. It's going to be a fully automatic rifle, and either fully automatic or at least burst automatic, in other words, the ability to fire more than one round with the pull of a trigger. Not one firearm that was affected in any way by the so-called assault weapons ban, which I like to call the scary-looking gun ban, actually was an assault rifle. So the fact that our assault weapons ban, misnamed as it was, expired in 2004 has absolutely nothing to do with the machine guns that are used by the gangs and the criminals in Mexico. It's just not even, it's completely ridiculous on its face to make that statement. In the first place, if you were to buy one of those in the United States, it would cost a small fortune to buy it legally. If you bought it illegally, okay, well, you know, that's a possibility. I'm sure there's some illegal trafficking where people are buying guns that aren't even in the legitimate firearms market in the United States, and maybe some of those are being transported to Mexico. More likely, it's guns that were purchased for Mexico, for their government, and for their military, directly from U.S. manufacturers, using military specifications like an M16, for example, and then those firearms are being stolen by or inappropriately transferred to the criminal element. And so that is one of the big things. And then the other one, which is actually more prevalent because the majority of the firearms that they're talking about are AK-47s, and we haven't been able to import fully automatic AK-47s into this country for a long time. You can't even import complete firearms that aren't fully automatic You have to can only import some parts, and then some of the U.S. manufacturers make the other parts. You have to have a certain number of U.S. manufactured parts in the firearm in order to be able to sell it in the United States. It's just ridiculous. And you can buy one for maybe $200, probably less than that, in places like the Middle East, and then ship truckloads or boatloads of those over into wherever. Mexico certainly is one of the possibilities. Venezuela is another place that gets a lot of those. And they're readily available for far less than you could get them here, and yet they blame the United States. It's just so ridiculous. It's hardly even worth discussing. But since it comes up in the media, we have no choice but to at least address it.
Well, and I just wanted to point out that it is ridiculous. And the other thing I want to mention is that there are plenty of laws already on the books, both at the local and federal level, and there's plenty of enforcement efforts currently in place to deal with those kinds of things. And it's stuff that's going on behind the scenes. And the problem I have with this is that they're basically attacking the law-abiding citizen by limiting their rights to keep and bear arms because of the efforts of a small group of criminal individuals who are going to do their trade anyway, no matter what laws you enact. Just like the assault weapons ban, I believe, existed for about 10 years, from 94 to 2004.
It was exactly 10 years.
Yeah, and the studies that have been done, and it's all been preliminary, it had little to no impact on crime in the United States before, during, or after the ban. So it really didn't. There were plenty of, just like then, and just like the situation exists now, there are plenty of laws on the books to address individuals when they get caught with these kinds of weapons. The problem is the bad guys don't play by the rules. Our criminal justice system hasn't been firm enough in keeping those individuals behind bars and getting them put away for long enough periods of time. They come out and they recidivate, meaning they commit additional criminal acts. And generally they get as violent, if not more violent, with each successive crime. But nonetheless, there are plenty of laws on the books. There are plenty of enforcement efforts currently in place. Yes, we can always do a little bit more, but I say enforce the laws we have and more aggressively enforce those laws and be a little bit more aggressive in the apprehension of those individuals, and you'll solve a lot of these problems.
And I'm a radical. I mean, I'm a Second Amendment absolutist. I think that the 27 words of the Second Amendment mean exactly what they say. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And although we have many laws in place already that can be used to prosecute criminals when they violate the laws and they do things that they're not supposed to do, unfortunately, many of those laws infringe our right to keep and bear arms. And we actually, instead of enforcing laws, we need to get rid of some of the laws, and then we can restore the right to keep and bear arms for the citizens, and the citizens are going to be much better able to defend themselves. And that is what brings crime down, when it is no longer a safe occupation for people to violate the law and cause harm to others, either by property or by to their personal safety. All of those actions are already illegal, whether you use a firearm or not. If you use a firearm to hold someone up instead of a knife, are they any less robbed? No, it's still robbery. It's still armed robbery, and it is still a felony. And so the fact that they used a gun doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just the way it is. So we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to go over to Charles Van Sant in the newsroom and get an update on what's going on in the world. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro here on Memorial Day weekend for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
God bless America. This is your blood brother, Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro in for Shooting from the Hip. We're glad that you're joining us today on this Memorial Day weekend. If you'd like to be on the show, give us a call at 457-1290. Jeff and I are here from Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's first indoor shooting range and firearms training center. If you'd like more information about the range, you can go to our website at sim-trainer.com. You can also get to our radio page from the homepage there, or go directly to it at sim-trainer.com/radio. And that's where you'll find the links to our Facebook page, to the podcast, as well as an archive of all of the previous shows with some brief show notes, as well as the audio files that you can download and listen directly online. Let's go back out. Let's go out to the phones. We haven't done that yet today. So let's go out to the phone and talk to Dan in Dayton. Dan, thanks very much for calling the show.
Yes, I was wondering about the, I heard something, well, in fact, I got a phone call this morning from the NRA about a conference the UN's going to hold, trying to ban all the guns around the world. And is that conference coming up soon?
Okay, that's a fair question. In fact, Jeff and I were talking about that a little bit earlier. There is an annual or recurring conference that the UN holds. It's on small arms and light weapons, and basically their agenda has been to ban small arms and light weapons, and they like to call them illegal arms. Unfortunately, what they're really talking about is complete disarmament, although they refuse to admit that. The problem with banning small arms is that the people that they take them from are the people who need them the most. They are the people who are oppressed by dictators and by despots across the world. And those dictators and despots are also members of the United Nations, and they really like to make sure that they can do their things unopposed. Unfortunately, with the current administration and Secretary of State, Secretary Hillary Clinton, she is a supporter of gun control, although she has been somewhat quiet in that regard. There is, unfortunately, a lot more rumor going on than there is truth. And I understand the NRA is using this as a fundraising tool, and I don't disagree with the fact that we do need to provide resources to folks like the NRA. There are only like two non-governmental organizations who are part of the discussion who are on our side, who are pro-gun. But there was a widely circulated email that went out in the last week that said that she had already signed a treaty, and that treaty has not been negotiated. In fact, it's not even going to be addressed. It'll be drafted sometime between now and 2012. So even if she were to be able to sign it before 2012, it would still have to be ratified by the Senate. And so that's where we can have our greatest impact.
Well, that means they better get out there in 2010 and vote the majority Senate.
That's correct. And although, now I think it's important to understand that the Senate, although it is a Democrat majority, it's also a pro-gun majority. When this Senate was sworn in, there were a group of senators and also congressmen, representatives, who wrote a letter, Democrat representatives and senators, who wrote a letter to President Obama and said, if you try to take up gun control anytime during this Congress, you are not going to have our support, and we will make sure that it fails, because we were elected based on our position on the support of the right to keep and bear arms, our support of the Second Amendment. And so if you try to do something that violates our Second Amendment, you will not have our support, and it will go down in flames, and it will be a very public down in flames. Nancy Pelosi is another one. She's in the House. She's a very anti-gun speaker of the House. And she has said, you know, we'd do it if we could, but we know we can't, so we're not even going to bring it up. So even though the traditionally the Republicans have been looked at as the pro-gun party, quite frankly, gun control and the right to keep and bear arms is a universal, nonpartisan issue. There are members on both sides of the aisle who are strongly supportive of the right to keep and bear arms. And that is where I think we have the best chance to defeat anything that would go that would go the wrong way if it were to happen that way in the UN. Now, it is unfortunate that we don't have someone like John Bolton in the United Nations. When he was actually an undersecretary, he was the UN Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. Right. And he made a statement in 2001 that basically said, you know, small arms and light weapons are, as we're talking about, are strictly the military arms. But there's a lot of problem with those. But we separate these from firearms such as hunting rifles and pistols, which are commonly owned and used by citizens in many countries. And he says, you know, so you better separate those, and if you consider all light weapons in the same category and the weapons that are owned by the civilians as part of this that you're trying to control, you're not going to have our support. And so you might as well give it up. And we don't have anybody right now that has that strong a view and is willing to take that stand. I think we need to. This is a classic example of elections having consequences.
Right.
Barack Obama stated very clearly that he supports gun control, even though he tried not to let that be too well known during the campaign, and he tried to put on a gun friendly mask during the presidential campaign in 2008. His own records, his own website, the transition website, and even the White House website after he took office, made it pretty clear that he would add gun control if he thought there was a way to do it. And I think that was part of the reason why pro-gun Democrats wrote that letter and told the White House, you better not go there.
Well, you just look at his administration, who he put in his cabinet, that Eric Holder, and all those anti-gunners in there, Feinstein, and
you're absolutely right. There's a lot of them.
Schumer from New York.
Right. Yeah. And of course, you know, they're not in his administration. They were elected. Feinstein and Schumer and several others were elected by their own districts and, you know, their own states to represent them in the Congress. And yeah, there's no question that those folks are anti-gun people.
They're way too long, these lifetime politicians.
Well,
they need a clean house.
I think you're right. And I think that it's important that those of us who are strong proponents of the right to keep and bear arms, that we need to pay attention when we go to the ballot, and we need to let our friends know and pay attention to the records of all of the candidates and make sure that that they really understand what it is that we believe and what they need to do to represent us. Dan, thanks very much for calling the show. Let's go out to Bruce in Vandalia. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question involves some of the concealed carry garments, vests, jackets, a tactical holster shirt.
Okay.
Would the Ohio law recognize the built-in holsters as a holster, or would you be required to put your gun in a separate holster to fit to meet the required concealed carry that you have to have your weapon in a holster?
Well, the only real issue there is going to be when you're traveling in a motor vehicle, that it be secured in a holster, quote-unquote. However, when you're out just in the general area, that's not an issue. I think the more critical issue for you is looking at the functional usefulness, and if it in fact is a holster that's going to secure the weapon, or if it's what I call a gimmick that they just basically took a shirt and they sewed a pocket into it.
And what they look like.
Yeah. And in many cases, that's what they've done. And I'm telling you that before you make a purchase decision, you need to really give it a test run and see if you can get a hold of one for testing and evaluation. Talk to some people. Get on some of the forums to see what other people have done. And my experience is, at least in law enforcement, very few, if any, are ever utilized because of the lack of functional usefulness. There are some that in specific incidents for small or for short-term duration may have some practical usefulness, but for the most part, and I really hate to go against some of the manufacturers, and I'm not going to dime out any of them in particular, but I'm just talking from the standpoint of functional usefulness because of the size of the gun, the dynamics of the gun, the sharp edges on the guns. They just don't work very well. There are some exceptions out there, and maybe we should devote a show to some after we've had a chance to do some testing and evaluation. I'm going to make a note of that issue here, but before you get involved in that, I want you to try to get some information yourself and try to do some homework on your own, because I say there's nothing that beats a good belt-mounted leather holster for security on your person. And I know people are always looking for ways to go lighter with less clothing, but you know it's hard to do that. And don't substitute safety and security for the convenience issue.
Bruce, let me address just one question about a vest. And I started when I first started carrying concealed, my wife and daughter bought me a vest. It's a vest that has a holster in it, and I wore that thing out. And at first I tried to wear it with the gun in the holster in the vest, and it was just a weight on the shoulders, and the nature of it made it very uncomfortable for a long-term wear. I mean, it was certainly something I could wear, but I couldn't take it off because now the gun's in the holster in the vest, so I can't take the vest off. It was okay for cooler weather. It didn't work so well for warmer weather, and long-term, I just decided, you know, I'm going to wear the vest by itself as a garment for cover rather than try to put the gun in it. We're out of time for our last break now, so we're gonna do that now. We'll be back in just a few minutes, and when we do that, we'll talk to Timothy and Bob on the phone, and we'll take your call at 457-1290. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedry in for Shooting from the Hip. Let's go directly out to the phones. We've got a lot to do in the next 10 minutes, so let's talk to Timothy in Englewood. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm what you call a pro-concealed carry Democrat.
Good.
My question is, states have a shield law in case you needed to use your firearm offensively, and it was ruled to shoot to protect you from being sued. Is there any chance for Ohio to get something like that?
You're talking about like the Castle Doctrine?
Well, we have a limited Castle Doctrine in Ohio, right?
That's correct, yes, and it applies when you're in a car or in your home.
Yeah, some states have a no-duty-to-retreat law. We don't have that, but
that's correct.
The question is involving a shield law
from
protecting you from being sued.
Okay, civil liability.
Yes.
There was an attempt in the last law, and there is some narrative in the last law that reduces the liability, or at least it's supposed to prevent and the criminal from coming back and suing the person who is defending themselves against the criminal's behavior. And not just the criminal, but the family of the criminal also would not be able to come back and sue you. That hasn't yet been tested in court, and so it's a little hard to say exactly what the answer is right there. We'll have to see what happens, but they did do that, and it would be great. I mean, that's certainly something to contact your legislators about and say, hey, you know, we really need to have we need to increase this and make that a lot stronger. Thanks for very much for calling the show. We've got a few other things we need to do. One of them is I want to talk about the Senate Bill 239, which and also Senate Bill 247, which passed the Ohio Senate this week. Senate Bill 239 would do two main things. It would remove the restrictions on how you carry in your car. So if you have a license to carry concealed handgun, you'd be able to carry it in whatever way you chose. Instead of right now, there are four specific ways. Now, this would open the door to pocket carry, to having a holster mounted in your vehicle, and those kinds of things currently not available. And the other thing that it would do is the big one that everybody's been waiting for quite some time is restaurant carry. It would allow you as a licensed person to carry a concealed handgun and go into an establishment that serves alcohol for you to, for example, have dinner at a steakhouse with your family. But as long as you're not consuming any alcohol, you'd be able to go into the facility while you're still carrying your firearm. There's another bill, 247, which is a little bit less controversial, and it would bring Ohio law in with federal statutes. Both of those laws passed the Senate by a 23-10 margin and will be headed over to the House. So contact your state representative. Let them know that you support Senate Bill 239 and Senate Bill 247. Jeff had a couple of comments because there was one of the articles that came out had some comments Go ahead, Jeff.
I just want to comment on a comment made by Mark Drum for the Ohio Fraternal Order of Police to the Buckeye Firearms Association in reference to Senate Bill 239. He said, quote, police are concerned that permit holders might begin using quick draw holsters that attach to the interior of the vehicle and leave a gun on the dashboard or even start twirling them in their hands. And then he went on to say that in bars, he's concerned that the designated shooter will replace the concept of designated driver. I have to tell you, first of all, Mark, if you're out there listening, give us a call and we'll try to get you on the air. If not this week, next week, I'm certainly going to try to look you up because I want to find out where you got this information, because I've been a police officer for 25 plus years and I've never heard any police officer express that opinion. It's just absolutely ludicrous to believe that these kinds of things are going to be happening, because we've now had the law in effect for, you know, going on 6 years, and there haven't been a noteworthy number of even a mentionable number of those incidents where there have been anything that's drawn the necessary attention to the law-abiding citizens. So we're going to follow up on this issue next week, because I'm concerned about information that I feel is being improperly disseminated about brothers and sisters in blue who have opinions that I don't think are being fairly represented here. And we'll take care of that next week.
So just to be clear, that was from an article in the Columbus Dispatch, and you'll be able to find that if you go to the Buckeye Firearms Association website, and we'll also link to it on our website. Let's go out to Bob in Waynesville, who has a comment about elections. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
What's your question or comment?
Well, first a comment. When you were talking about Feinstein, Schumer, and Boxer, one thing that I've been following is California. And Boxer is vulnerable.
Yes, she
and
is.
If we could get rid of one of the three of that triad of anti-gunners with Kennedy out, I think we're going to do a lot better in the Senate as a whole as far as firearms laws go in the future.
Yeah, very typically these elections are based on local issues, but this one is getting very, very a lot of national attention for some of these Senate and House races across the country. So Boxer really is quite vulnerable, and so, you know, that's a great idea.
There's nothing that says you can't contribute. Of course, there are limits and whether or not it's tax deductible, so you can always check that out. The next comment, well, it's more of a question, guys. I'm kind of rusty here. What is concealed carry now in a vehicle, specifically a motorcycle?
A motorcycle is considered a motor vehicle, and so it's exactly the same as if you were driving a car. In a holster on your person, glove box and console, not so much an option. It can be in a package. It could be closed in a saddlebag, or if you've got a, you know, something like that, you'd be able to close it in there. It can also be in a package, case or box that's closed, as long as it's in plain sight, or in a locked case, and that does not have to be in plain sight. Those are exactly the same as in a car.
Okay. Because I'm kind of curious, there's no easy way to store a firearm, because as you were talking earlier about, you can't carry into a restaurant that serves alcohol today, so it's kind of difficult to get off and in plain sight to unholster, you know,
yeah,
put away your firearm and then go inside, eat,
and that
out.
Really depends on the nature of how you carry and also the type, you know, what type of bags you might have on your motorcycle. I drove a Goldwing until I rolled it last spring and broke it completely, so... but that was had hard trunk, so I could lock stuff in the hard trunk pretty easily.
The challenge, I think, isn't so much locking it in the trunks. I have hard
doing it discreetly.
It's just doing it in the parking lot.
I agree. Right. I agree.
Yeah. You always hear the stories of somebody becoming excited because they see a firearm and, oh my God, it might run out and shoot somebody.
Right.
And we all know that happens.
Yeah,
exactly.
Not at all. And that's kind of the point. Hey, Bob, thanks very much for calling the show. Let's go out to Jim in Dark County. Jim, you have a question for us about concealed carry laws.
Well, it's more about the ammunition.
Okay.
What I'm interested in is the difference between a 9mm Luger and a 9mm Parabellum shell, for example.
Okay, those are the same. That's both 9x19, which is a 9mm diameter and a 19mm high case. 9mm Parabellum, 9mm Luger, and 9x19, those are all the same.
All right, fine. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for calling the show. And you hear the music, so we are out of time. Spend a few minutes this weekend on Memorial Day remembering those who have sacrificed the ultimate sacrifice for us to be able to retain our freedom, to live in a free country, to express ourselves, and to be able to go out to the store and get stuff that we can celebrate with our families and our friends in relative safety. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.